We know a woman, she had a family friend, who grew up in an Italian family. She loved so much. She loved her Italian family. She loved her heritage. It became really a core part of who she was. I am an Italian woman, she would say. And my sister uses her marinara sauce recipe to this day, you know. True Italian. But when she was in her 50s and her mother was on her deathbed, her mother revealed the great family secret that she was adopted. And she was actually not Italian at all, she was Jewish. This really rocked her world. And her mother explained why she had to keep it a secret. She said, in our community, a woman's value was so tied to her ability to produce children, to mother a family, that there was a sense of shame if she could not do this. And so her mother engineered an absence for a time, talked of a pregnancy, and came back with a birth. And she could never tell her daughter because she could never tell anyone, her friends or her family, that this is what she had done until she lay dying. I tell this story because it is easy to read the words of Hannah, a woman who longed for a child, whose value was tied up in bearing children, and think about that as something that happened a long time ago in a place far away, but not something quite so close to home. And yet, I know people, and perhaps you know people too, or perhaps you are a person who has experienced this kind of experience of Hannah. But before we get too far into the story of Hannah, I want to back up a little bit. As you've been hearing, our church is working our way through the Bible this year. We are kind of going chronologically through, and of course, trying to do this in 9 months, we can't tell every story of the Bible, so I want to catch us up a little bit. Last week, we found the people of Israel worshiping inappropriately with a golden calf, and a lot has happened between then and the story of Hannah today. So we need to catch up a little bit. The people of Israel have spent, the Hebrew people have spent 40 years in the wilderness, and then they have eventually come into the land where they will reside. That sort of takes us into the book of Joshua, and Joshua recounts that entrance into the land and those first years there, and then we go through the book of Judges, and Judges is a very distressing time. It's a very chaotic, one of the most violent times for the people of Israel, and it is sort of in this moment and out of this time that we reach our story today, our story of Hannah. And so we come to Hannah in a time of national discomfort. They're seeking leaders, they're seeking guides, they're seeking a way to come together and to follow God, but they haven't really found their footing in the land yet. Now, it's true that there aren't a lot of stories of women in the Bible. And so, when we find one, it usually is a signal that something significant is happening. For instance, the stories before this of Hannah and Rahab, among others, are stories that signal a shift in the people of God, a shift in what's going on. And that is true for the story of Hannah, too. This will be the shift for us between the time of the judges, which were sort of this loose, kind of almost anarchy kind of time, and then the shift into a monarchy for the people of Israel. Hannah will birth Samuel, and Samuel will be the one who anoints the first kings of Israel. And so this story of Hannah signals both this personal story of Hannah seeking, and what as Adrian said so beautifully, what her heart most desires, and God responding to her. And it also signals a time and a shift in the people of God. So it's an important story. She's an important person in the Bible. And often the stories of women, not always, but many of the stories of women in the Bible, especially in the Old Testament, are stories of women wishing for children. And what we need to recognize is that often those stories are both personal stories, but they often come at a time when the people of God are also metaphorically barren and need to come into a time of more fruitfulness. And that's certainly true with Hannah's story as well. Now, the verses before the section that Katrina beautifully read for us today set the scene. And the story of Hannah actually begins by talking about the family situation. It's a pretty dysfunctional family situation. You see, Hannah is one of two wives, and the other wife has children, and Hannah does not. And so in the verses that we didn't add in today, what we see is the other wife belittling Hannah, and Hannah feeling great shame because of this. And then of course, we see that sort of again when Hannah comes in and she's praying and Eli sees her and he makes assumptions about her that she's drunk. And in both cases, she has to advocate for herself because, frankly, the people around her are not advocating for her. She's being treated badly because of her status. And frankly, we see that today. We see that today as people make assumptions about people based on their status. They make assumptions about their value in many, many ways. I remember when I was a hospital social worker in my late 20s, and Richard and I were not quite yet ready to begin our family. We did that soon thereafter. But at that time, we were not quite ready. And I had another coworker about my age. We worked for a boss who was a man who had a large family, and periodically he would come to us and he would tease us, saying, "When are you two going to get busy and start a family?" Now, for me, that was a little bit annoying and felt a little like a boundary crossing. But for my friend, who I knew had been trying with her husband for a while to start a family and couldn't, it was a punch to the gut. But neither of us, because of the power dynamics, felt that we could say anything or challenge this. Now, that's just one little story of a microaggression. There are bigger stories. Often women's identity and value in countries through the ages and cultures around the world have been tied so closely to their fertility that we hear these cries of Hannah today and through the ages. One woman prays and heartbreakingly cries because the baby she hopes for is not there, and another woman prays and heartbreakingly cries because she has been consigned to a life of bearing children without her choice and in lieu of her gifts and her true call and sometimes her very life and health. And so women's power, it both comes and is given because of their ability to bear a child, or it is limited and cut off because they are assumed that they will only bear children The truth is that we must remember that Hannah was a loved and valued person in God's eyes, both before and after she bore this child. She loved God, and God loved her. And so she came and she prayed in the temple. Now, the truth is, the church has not always been very good about how we handle this whole issue of fertility. Today, we will, with great joy and great appropriateness, celebrate the dedication of children among us and the joy of a family who has borne these children. And that is right and good, and we will rejoice when we do so together. The gift of children is indeed a gift and worth celebrating. But it is also true at the same time that churches have not always been good about equally valuing lives that look different than this. They have been accused of being so family friendly that those who don't have that kind of a family are not always welcomed or may feel on the outside. And so we hold together these two difficult truths. On the one hand, children are something to be celebrated, and they make us feel joyful, and we are so glad to have them in a family of faith. And at the other hand, we are so glad for God's work in each person's life, no matter what form that takes, and it may take many different forms. And so it is easy for us to read Hannah's prayer as a God will give you whatever you want kind of prayer. But maybe in some ways we need to step back and sort of think about what Hannah's prayer really has to say. Because it's hard to hold all of these things together. And I think Hannah's song, these beautiful words of Hannah that are recorded that Katrina read for us, really help us to do that. There have been stories of women who have prayed in the Bible prior to Hannah's story, prior to 1 Samuel. But Hannah's is the first prayer in which we get to hear her voice singing this beautiful psalm, this psalm that is generally thought to be the basis of the even more familiar psalm that Mary sings when she learns that she is with child. These words of Hannah's that we still speak today because of all they teach us. And rather than teaching us only that God gave her what she wanted, I think they teach us something even more important than that. They teach us something about who God is and how this experience for Hannah helped reveal that greater sense of who God was. Yes, in the first verse of the song that she sings, she speaks personally of how God has heard her. She actually speaks more about how God has lifted her up from the derision of others than she does actually about the birth itself. But by verse 2, she is already speaking of our God. It is no longer just a prayer about me and God. It is a prayer about a God of the people, a God who will do great things. And it goes on to speak about more than Hannah's specific experience with God, but how God will act for those who are in need, the feeble, the poor, the needy. For these people, God will reach, God cares. And in a society where often people were blamed for their own unfortunate circumstances, this psalm speaks of a God who is not punishing them in that way, This is a God who cares about them, who loves them, who will lift them up, who will hear their prayers, who will reverse the fortunes of many. That kind of reversal that we hear again and again in Mary's prayer. It is a prayer of a God who hears the oppressed and the downtrodden, those who suffer and have need. Not a prayer about a Santa Claus and the mall God who will give us whatever we want for Christmas. Sometimes we want the Santa God. It sounds kind of good, but that's a pretty small God, really. A God that we control. No, this is a God who is portrayed as mighty and powerful. A God who created heaven and earth and yet cares about the lost and the least among us. This is a God who is the judge, not those of who we experience who judge us. No, the only judge that we have to care about is our God. And it's hard to hold all these things together, this desires that we bring to God, the joys that we feel. Sometimes, in fact, it's so hard that on the one hand, some folks just will tout all of the Santa God kind of language, and other folks will swing to the other extreme. And even when we feel in our heart that God has in fact answered our prayers, we will not claim that because of others that seem to have unanswered prayers, or at least prayers not answered in the way that they hoped. And so we say nothing. Neither of which really honors the God that we serve. Reflecting on this, one commentator puts it this way. He says, joy and gratitude in our broken world can sometimes strike a false note. They can feel platitudinous and glib. Isn't it presumptuous to claim God's personal favor? A narcissistic indulgence? And what about the millions who suffer and all the unanswered prayers? Those are important questions. But the audacious idea of the personal care of a transcendent God isn't an evangelical invention. It's a gift from the Hebrew imagination. This idea of a transcendent, powerful, mighty God who, in fact, still offers personal care, personal listening, personal interaction, personal answers to our prayers is something we believe because we have heard the stories. The story of Hannah and the stories of others. And if we were to audaciously tell our own stories to each other about God's work in our lives, which we probably don't do enough, we would also feel the stories. And yes, there is a mystery about prayer and about why sometimes it seems like we get what we asked for and sometimes we do not. We do still trust in a God who is working in the world to create good. And I think part of understanding prayer can be understood by looking at this story. We are told about the prayer of Hannah, but when we look at the bigger context of what was going on in Israel, well, this was before sort of the nation building in the same sort of way, but when we look at what was going on for this people, I feel confident that Hannah's was not the only prayer being lifted to God. Like I said, this was one of the most violent and chaotic periods of the people ever. I am sure in my heart that there were many prayers that were going up to God for stability, for care, for a path out of this time of chaos and violence and oppression. I am sure that Hannah's prayer was not the only prayer. And don't we know of times and places where the violence and the chaos and the oppression seems overwhelming, and we cannot imagine the path out. And yet, God is working through each and every prayer. And the way out will almost certainly come, as it almost always has come, through simple prayers like those of Hannah's. And from God's work in the lives of simple, unimportant people like Hannah. Because, in fact, the answer to Hannah's prayer was not simply an answer for Hannah. It was an answer for the people of God. The beginning of a shift in what would happen. Another step on their journey. And those shifts and those steps almost always start not with the bombastic, not with the powerful, but with the lowly, simple people, with our lowly, simple prayers. Because God cares for the feeble. God cares for the needy. God cares for each and every one of us.